Right now, we're going to take a little break from our coronavirus coverage to talk about something we all think about, and that's social class. The majority of us, 70% according to Pew Research, believe we're part of the middle class. But as income inequality grows, there is a new distinct class that is also growing, and our next guest calls it the aspirational class. Elizabeth Kierit-Halkett is a professor at the University of Southern California, and she joined me in studio last week to talk about this new burgeoning class. In your book, you coined this term, aspirational class. What exactly is it, and who's a part of it?
So the aspirational class is really unified not so much by money. We often think about class as something to do with socioeconomics.
Yes.
And while they tend to be better off than most Americans, the real relationship between the people in the aspirational class is their shared sense of social and cultural practices and norms. A really good example that we'll all know is shopping at Whole Foods.
Yes.
And when I was thinking about this book, one thing I noticed is, of course, you had very well-to-do people shopping at Whole Foods. But I also remember going to Whole Foods and seeing lots of people who, you know, young college students and graduate students. And mm-hmm. I knew my friends who were screenwriters, you know, looking for a gig were shopping at Whole Foods. And it was, you know, maybe they shouldn't spend $5 on strawberries, but they were doing it because they were organic and they were local and they cared about those values. And it was mm-hmm. it's those values that I think unify the aspirational class.
I want to talk more about those values. But first, I want to talk a little bit about this core argument of your book, which really draws from the social theorists who believe consumption is part of how we define ourselves. It's a signal of our socioeconomic position, as you mentioned, with Whole Foods. What does this theoretical concept look like in other ways in the real world?
So it plays out in two different ways. So I was really inspired by Thorstein Veblen. And, you know, a lot of people don't know who he is, but they know the term conspicuous consumption,
yes,
which is the use of material goods to show social position. And what I started thinking about when I was writing this book was the fact that it's not about fancy watches and shoes anymore in the way that it might have been in the 1980s and certainly in Veblen's time when we think about his famous silver spoons,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that, you know, you could own a silver spoon and it wasn't more useful than a spoon of a different metal, but you could own one. So that must mean you had enough money to. And
that's
so
right.
We don't really do that as much today because material goods are so omnipresent that you can, you know, even if we thought about like knockoff culture, you know, people can kind of fake that. But what they can't fake is the time and the accrual of knowledge to make certain decisions about consumption.
Hmm.
And so some examples of this are the upper middle class spends, you know, something like 8 times more exercising than the lower income groups.
Hmm.
And you see
in the way of exercise classes, those types of things.
Exercise classes, which are expensive.
Yes.
If you think about a yoga class or a Pilates class, but also they have the time in the sense of flexibility. So I think that that's something, if you really contrast, say, someone who's an hourly worker to even someone who has a very high-pressure job like a lawyer, but they still have some control over their schedule and the ability to take lunch hour, to go to the gym, and there is a gym down the street from where they work. And so I think that that's a really good way of seeing it, not just in terms of expense, as in it's expensive to exercise, but also in terms of day-to-day habits.
Yes.
And time.
Time,
yes.
Absolutely. We all know it. We all think about it. We all kind of put ourselves in a particular class. But there is no real definition for social classes, truly, official definitions. What do you think is missing for us in really thinking about that? And do we actually need that? Do we need a defined idea of what is a particular class? What does that mean for us?
I think that is the problem with social class, is that I think it is hard to pinpoint these days because it's not just about money anymore. And, you know, if we think about, you know, the kid who graduates from Yale or Princeton with a poetry degree, you know, he's not going to work on Wall Street, but he has, you know, a higher social class than that guy who worked so hard as a real estate broker and, you know, lives in New Jersey. And mm-hmm. it's very confusing. But I think what we really see now, and I think this is actually why it's so hard, is that because culture and knowledge are so much a part of social class and position now, they take a long time to earn. Mm-hmm. So that's where social class is somewhat intractable now in this country, and it becomes hard. Even the conduits in which we are mobile, like college, they are hard to get into now. It's not how do you become the kind of student that a college wants. Well, it's not simply just writing, you know, a
great essay and having a 4.0. Yeah,
exactly.
We also can't talk about class in this country without talking about race. And all of these markers that you're talking about, Whole Foods, NPR, the coffee shops that you go to, the Mommy and Me classes, they also kind of signal something else, and that's white. Can you talk a little bit more about that? And I will say I'm all of those things, and I'm not white. Mommy and Me down to Whole Foods, down to working at NPR.
You know, that's a really great observation. I think one of the reasons is because what we've seen historically is that the upper end of the socioeconomic totem pole has been historically white. And so there is this dominant hegemony around the practices of upper middle class white people. And I think that again, actually adds to the observation you made before, which is that it makes people uncomfortable. And minorities tended to be greater conspicuous consumers. And this is because when you are a minority, you feel you have to prove yourself more.
Yeah.
And so you conspicuously consume to signal, I'm here, mm-hmm. I fit in. And so, you know, in a way, if we contrast that in the other end, you know, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, WASPs, there's this, you know, kind of joke about the beat up barber coat and the sweater with the moth holes. And,
yep.
You know, they don't have to try
yeah.
because their social position is clear.
Yeah.
And so I think that is a really important observation. And it also is, I think, it'll be interesting to see over time how that evolves. Mm-hmm. Some sociologists talk about this notion of being a cultural omnivore, which is this idea that, you know, you do go to Whole Foods, but you love the taco stand down the street from you.
Yeah.
And it's this sort of sense of like the different kinds of, you know, ethnic and cultural consumption habits you have. But again, I think it's a luxury to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so do we return again to the fact that even if social class today is not simply about money, it has historical ties to upper middle class white people who have had money over time when other groups have not.
You know, I'm thinking about this is an election year. And so in addition to things like juicing and cycling and all of these signals to folks, the candidates we support are also a means of signaling to people about not only our political ideas, but our status. Is that something that you also think about?
Absolutely. And one of the things that was really interesting when my book first came out was it was on the heels of the 2016 election. The people who engaged with the book in the public sphere kept talking about that my book was representative of, you know, some of the divisions, the cultural divisions in this country. You know,
socially and politically.
Absolutely. One person who interviewed me set it up with a hillbilly elegy. So this is one story of America. And then these are the coastal elites and their cultural practices, which are alien to everyone other than themselves. It's so insular. And this is what's wrong with America. So I believe this, and I'm working on another book right now, that we have to, more than even socioeconomics, it's cultural divisions in this country and an understanding cultural cohesion that's going to help things. If we could start understanding each other a little more instead of the conversation being about cultural divides, which exist, it may actually be more of a story of cultural cohesion and to find those through lines and actually to see that you can live in Los Angeles and have more in common with someone who lives in small town Minnesota than you do maybe to someone who lives in the neighborhood adjacent to you. And that's a better picture and actually a more hopeful one, because no one's saying we don't have things to repair in this country. But what we might be able to say is there is an America – as in one that is tied to one another.
This book really lays this out in great detail. But now we know it. What does it mean? And how do we move forward?
We don't seem to be talking to each other.
Yeah.
And so that's about something that's not just money.
Hmm.
That is about culture. And that's about cultural cohesion. And I think, to me, one of the most important things is to first try to find what we might have in common, and also find out how we can provide access to cultural capital. And that's something I think is missing now, is that, you know, I think a lot of social mobility depends on things that, frankly, start at age five.
Hmm.
And so it's not as simple as, like,
we're talking about education. Yeah.
Education, absolutely.
Right.
You completely get it. It's about access to a diverse and enriched life. And that really actually is quite rarefied today.
Elizabeth Currid Halkett is the James Irvine Chair of Urban and Regional Planning and Professor of Public Policy at the University of Southern California. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure, Tanya. Thank you.